You're relieved of your position. Cobb, remove Mr. Hunter from the control room. Get Lieutenant Zimmer in here right now.
No, sir. I do not concur, and I do not recognize your authority to relieve me under command under Navy regulations.
Cobb, arrest this man and get him out of here!
Under operating procedures governing the release of nuclear weapons, we cannot launch our missiles unless both you and I agree.
Cobb, what are you waiting for?
Sorry, sir. This is expressly why your command must be repeated. It requires my assent. I do not give it. And furthermore, you continue upon this course and insist upon this launch without confirming this message first. I will be
Chief of the boat.
Back by the rules of precedence.
Captain, commanding officer
command,
of the USS Alabama. I order you to place the XO under arrest on the charge of
Navy regulations.
I say again, I order you to place the XO under arrest on the charge of mutiny.
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan. Welcome, everybody, to another episode. Today, we're going to be joined by my brother, Graham Flanagan, all the way from New York City. And we want to welcome Graham right now. Graham, how are you?
Hey, guys. Doing good. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know all three of us are going to be a little saddened about how we start today's episode. We're all big fans of the late Tony Scott's work, and news came early this week that Tony Scott committed suicide by throwing himself off of a bridge in California. What we do know is that we love this man's films, and we're sad to see a great director, a fantastic storyteller, a reliable studio filmmaker, and a technician and innovator, I think, in the industry in many respects, pass away. So, Graham and Corey, I just kind of want to open it up to you guys to talk a little bit about your favorite Tony Scott films, maybe just a handful of them, because I know personally there are 10 of them that I love. I love this guy's movies, and while he's probably not going to be considered, quote, an important filmmaker among the likes of the Hitchcocks and the Kubricks, I just love his movies, and I think that goes a super long way when you're talking about your favorite filmmakers. So it was a sad loss for me, but Corey, I'll open it up to you first. Talk a little bit about your favorite Tony Scott movies.
Well, there's no question, I think, that the modern blockbuster would look radically different without the innovations of Tony Scott and his 80s filmography. Films like Beverly Hills Cop 2 and especially Top Gun, which sort of paved the way, I think, for the aesthetic feel that a lot of our modern blockbusters have. Except I think it's probably still done better there than in many Michael Bay movies, for example, or big bloated spectacles that we get these days. My favorite Tony Scott movies, I mean, he had this really great run in the 90s in which he produced movies like True Romance and my personal favorite movie of his, Crimson Tide. But it's later in his career where his movies got more experimental with a sort of more offbeat style, as in Man on Fire and Domino. And I really respond to those movies too, because it just goes to show that even in his 60s, when he made those movies, Tony Scott was more willing, I think, to experiment with the medium of film than a lot of his younger peers. And that's something that, well, I'm going to miss a lot.
Graham, before Tony Scott passed away a couple of weeks ago, you told me about a Blu-ray purchase that you made, which you said was one of the best sounding and looking Blu-rays that you had ever seen or heard. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, a couple of weekends ago, I watched Days of Thunder on Blu-ray for the first time in a long time, and I loved it. It got better. You know, it was a better experience for me than I'd had previously seeing it a few years ago. I saw that movie in the theater in its initial release, probably its first weekend. Ben, I can't remember exactly. You were probably there. It was at the Bama 6 in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, I was there.
And, you know, I had a blast seeing it then, but it really holds up, and it is just a blast. It's not just about the action. It's not just about the cars and the sound. The sound editing was nominated for an Oscar, I should add. He was a great director of actors, as I'm sure, you know, Corey mentioned Crimson Tide. As we heard in the intro to the show, the performances from Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington, I mean, this guy was much more than an action director. I mean, he was a movie director. As far as movies of his that I loved, there are really only three that I love. Top Gun, obviously, and then Days of Thunder and Crimson Tide. Then there are two that I really like a lot, which are Enemy of the State, which a lot of people have been giving a lot of credit in the last few days, which has been comforting. And then also, I really enjoyed The Fan, which is sort of underrated, and it got panned sort of, but I think it's a really fun exploitation movie. There are some movies of his that didn't really do it for me, like Man on Fire, Domino. Last Boy Scout is entertaining. I'd like to see it again, but I'd put it in the 2.5 star range, like C+ range. But I really want to see it again. Hopefully I'll change my mind. And then there are movies of his that I have yet to see, which may surprise you. I have not seen, I'm looking at his filmography, I have not seen Deja Vu. I have not seen Spy Game. I have never sat down and watched True Romance all the way through. And then I've never seen Revenge. And then another one that I just cannot believe that I have not seen all the way through is Beverly Hills Cop 2. So I'm really looking forward to sitting down and just going back and watching some of these movies and enjoying them and sort of rediscovering him.
You know, Man on Fire did it for me. I really liked that movie a lot. And I think during the latter part of his career, or I guess the second wave of his career, where he really dropped this new style on us in terms of how he shot, edited, used music in his movies. You had Man on Fire, Deja Vu, Domino, and even Unstoppable, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. They were distinctly Tony Scott movies. He had established a style that you now see in music videos, other films, and even commercials now that is totally his own. So of that era, I would say my favorite films of his are Man on Fire, Unstoppable, and Domino, because I really enjoy that film. But in between there, you had Enemy of the State, which is sort of in between that early era of blockbusters that you talked about with Top Gun and Days of Thunder and Crimson Tide, films I also love, and these other films. And I think Enemy of the State, if I had to pick one, would definitely be my favorite. It's just a really great conspiracy theory, blockbuster, popcorn action movie, and that's what he's great at doing. Yes, they're big, loud action movies, but they make you think enough. And I think somebody who can just let you sit there for two straight hours and just entertain the hell out of you while making you think a little bit, that means you're a good filmmaker. I don't think you have to justify anything for Tony Scott or apologize for any of his work. And when you're trying to consider him as a great filmmaker, I think it speaks for itself. And I would just recommend that anybody go back and watch the bulk of his filmography and they'll agree.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 remake, but I think that's the only of his sort of latter career movies that didn't really do it for me. And, you know, we reviewed Unstoppable on this program when it came out, and I think we both really responded to it. So it's comforting in a way to know that he went out on a high note and he went out still doing what he did best. But looking forward to a new Tony Scott movie was something that I always had, and now that's no longer the case. But his filmography is strong, and those movies that he did make are rewatchable, and you know, a lot of them, like The Last Boy Scout, really do get better every time. That movie is quite good.
Corey, a lot of the sentiments that you shared were echoed in Edgar Wright's blog post, his sort of tribute or obituary for Tony Scott that he posted this week. That if you haven't read it, I would highly recommend anybody listening to this program to seek out Edgar Wright, director of Scott Pilgrim and Hot Fuzz, which is basically a tribute to Tony Scott in many ways, to read what he has to say about Tony Scott. It's sort of the ultimate tribute from a filmmaker who is directly influenced by Tony Scott.
Let's move on and get into the bulk of what we're here to talk about today, and it's movie ensembles. And we have a pair of films that have been recently released theatrically that feature ensemble casts, albeit they are very different films.
I'd say so.
And we'll get into reasons why. And we're going to give you our top five movie ensembles, where we give you three of our favorites, one underrated, and one worst ensemble in movie history. And we'll get to that a little bit later. And a film that may or may not have been better in the hands of the late Tony Scott or Edgar Wright, we'll start off with The Expendables 2.
I'm back.
You can't let the contents of that safe fall into the wrong hands. What's the plan?
Track them, find them, kill them.
Here we go!
How did you do that?
Lucky me.
Get in!
His shoe is bigger than this car.
Shoe something!
Graham, you called me recently after seeing this movie in a packed house in New York City. And I know there's really no experience like seeing any movie, be it a new Sylvester Stallone action movie or a Woody Allen film, in a packed house in New York City. So tell us a little bit about where you saw the film, what that was like, that theatrical experience, and just what you thought of The Expendables 2, because I know you had high expectations going into this series and perhaps even higher going into this second one following what we consider a so-so initial effort.
No, I agree with you. The first movie was sort of a letdown, even though it does have its moments. And I got to put it in the plus column as a piece of pure entertainment. But it had a lot of problems. And I think that those problems were improved upon big time in this one. I had a blast. I loved it. I was laughing and cheering the entire way through, as was the rest of the theater. It was, like Ben said, a packed house at the multiplex that's on 34th Street right by Penn Station and Madison Square Garden. Like, you walk outside and there's Madison Square Garden. So it was a Tuesday night, and it was a packed house at about 7:15, and everybody in the crowd was, like you said, it was an experience. They were yelling at the screen, and when there would be a great kill or a great fight scene, people would say stuff like, "Told you!" There was one instance, and I don't want to spoil anything, but I'm going to spoil it, okay? This is a spoiler, but it's not that big of a deal. There's a scene where it seems like the Expendables are pinned down and there's no way out for them, but then all the bad guys that they're facing all get shot at once. And you're just like, what? What was that? And this dude next to me, who I didn't know, he goes, "Chuck Norris." And I was like, I think he's right. And then sure enough, Chuck Norris walks out to the Ennio Morricone music. And that was just a great moment. I mean, and then that happens twice in the movie. So they figured it out. And like, Jean-Claude Van Damme, you know, played it perfectly. Just a sleazy bad guy. I just thought it worked. Nothing about the movie really frustrated me. Other than the only problem I have with it is that they didn't give Sylvester Stallone like a sleazy 80s love scene with the female lead. They were afraid to do that in the previous movie, and they're afraid to do it here. And that's the one element that I think this movie was lacking, which a real 80s action movie like this has a scene like that.
Corey, I'm mostly on Graham's side with this one. Like you, I wasn't a big fan of the first one. I tried to convince myself as I was watching it that it was a lot better than it ended up being, because you want something like this, which works so well on paper, to translate on film. And with Sylvester Stallone at the helm there, I think it just didn't quite gel, especially when two of your biggest stars only participate in a 3-minute scene where they're all standing around and talking, and I don't even think in the same shot. Guys like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bruce Willis couldn't be in the same place at one time. That's not the case this time. You have these guys who had such a limited role in the first one participating and picking up the guns and shooting away and killing bad guys in a final half hour in a climax that I think makes up for most of where the Expendables really fell short in the first film and the first half of this film. I think this one started a little clunky like the first movie. The humor was just as bad, and I mean really bad. The first one was just awful. But I think that Sylvester Stallone handing the reins over to a guy like Simon West, who does have action experience in a film like Con Air, which I know that we love in certain ways, this isn't as slick as that. I'll say this isn't as slick as the 80s and early 90s action movies that Graham is referencing, unfortunately, but it seems like they're having a lot more fun this time, and the action sequences feel a lot more polished. And even though it is a little rough around the edges, and it has some characters that I think we could do without, like Randy Couture, and even, I hate to say it, Terry Crews, once these legends get on screen and Stallone and Simon West finally give them something to do and give them a gun to shoot, I think this movie actually really takes off and we have the fun that we thought we would have the first time.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I would call this a good movie exactly, but it certainly is satisfying in a way that the first movie was not. And it presents this carnage and mayhem, like you said, in a much more polished way, with a sense of scale that the first movie didn't have, which is weird because the first movie centered around a coup in a Central American country. It just feels like it was shot in, you know, an open field somewhere. But the second movie, I mean, you know, it ups the stakes. It adds more actors, including, like you said, Jean-Claude Van Damme, who's having a blast here, and I had a blast watching him. And, you know, there's just something about it. Maybe more of the jokes connected with me this time around, even though they were all uniformly either, you know, winking references to other movies or pretty groan-worthy one-liners. But nevertheless, I just, you know, I had a lot more fun watching this. And, you know, there's still some of the same clunky plot elements that the first movie had. You know, Liam Hemsworth's character, that whole arc is telegraphed within seconds of him popping up on the screen. And, you know, I was kind of personally bugged that Jet Li got out of that movie as fast as he could. But for what it was, and for being this cheesy, unabashedly silly action movie, I had a good time with it.
Yeah, and I agree with Graham that Van Damme brought it here like he certainly needed to. And I hope he comes back for a third one. And
somehow,
because if there's something that we know about Jean-Claude Van Damme, twins are not a problem. And that's a trend in his filmography that we've seen before. So hopefully they get creative and maybe we'll see Van Damme for a third time around. But Graham, you and I were sort of having a little fun the other night when you had just seen this movie. And like we would back when we were kids in the early 90s, we were just sort of going off on scenes that we really liked. Oh, you remember that part? It was awesome. There are several of those scenes in this. I think the opening sequence is really awesome. Graham, I know you were particularly fond of the first action sequence that this film opens up with, but you have the Expendables charging in on this fortress, it seems, where this person with a bag over his head is being held and they're going to sort of rescue him, and you kind of have an idea of who that is with the bag on his head. There's just this really awesome set piece or moment where Sylvester Stallone drives a motorcycle into a helicopter that's in midair.
Yeah.
And that just made me think, you know what? Exactly.
Yep.
That's why I'm here. But Graham, talk a little bit about some of your favorite parts.
You know, I was worried that the movie that we were going to see subsequent to that opening scene was going to slow down and never really live up to it. And luckily, the movie, I felt like the momentum, of course, it had to slow down at times, but never to a point where I felt like, oh, this isn't doing that first scene justice. I thought that the first scene, I mean, I want to go back and break it down. You know, there's just so much going on. And that'll definitely be on my list, at least for honorable mention at the end of the year when we do our best scenes of the year. But one of my favorite instances, other than the when Chuck Norris walks in, that's my favorite scene in the movie, or favorite moment in the movie. But I love when Van Damme spin kicks that knife into that dude's chest. I mean, that was pretty cool. Like, you know, pretty awesome kill. And just like a classic creative 80s action movie way to take somebody out, you know, that we remember from movies like Commando and Predator and all the Rambo movies and things like that. So among many, many great moments, those are the ones that sort of stuck out to me.
Yeah, and this movie had the one-liners too, and Van Damme had his fair share before he commences with that roundhouse kick into the character's chest, and it did the movie a favor too by getting rid of a character that it certainly didn't need, and I was ready to see go. But Corey, any other sequences stick out for you?
I'm really fond of the opening action sequence too, but near the end when all of these characters sort of improbably converge on this small Eastern European airport and basically tear the damn thing down, that's pretty fun, particularly when two characters get in a very small automobile and drive through the concourse there. I must admit, even though they were both like trading references to one another's movies, that's the sort of thing that would normally bother me, but I still got this really like geeky thrill at seeing it play out anyway.
Yeah, the geekiest thrill I had, again, I was a big Van Damme fan growing up as a kid. We had, Graham and I had a couple of cousins who were really into like martial arts movies, and they had HBO, and they had access to R-rated movies when we were kids, and so we'd be spending the night at their house on weekends quite a bit, and they introduced us, I think, to Van Damme movies, and we got into, you know, Bloodsport and Lionheart and obviously Double Impact and movies like that, thanks to those guys. So it was a big thrill for me to see him, even as a villain on screen, and I thought the sequence, like Graham had mentioned, when the Expendables meet Van Damme's group, the goat neck guys, I can't really remember the name.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it really doesn't. But I just thought Van Damme had some really great smarmy lines during that sequence when he's trying to teach the Expendables how to respect him in the way that they should. And he does it in some very violent ways. But I love the cheesy 80s and 90s dialogue in that sequence. And again, if you're going into this expecting much more than the things we've already raved about, you're going to be extremely disappointed.
Yeah.
And all you really need to know is that this film gets done what it meant to do. And if your standard is relatively low going into it, then I think you're going to have a good time.
Congratulazioni, e c'è tutto pagato. Sono tutta tua, tutta per te.
Ma guardi che ci deve essere un errore.
Io sono qui per soddisfare i tuoi sogni.
I lived in Rome for a year when I was your age.
Ah.
This might have been my exact street.
Come on in, my girlfriend makes great espresso.
My friend just broke up with her boyfriend.
I told her she could stay with us.
She's smart and funny. Men just adore her. I think it's because of the sexual vibe that she gives off.
I always had a little yen for sleeping with a woman. When I finally did it, it was incredible.
She's something, isn't she?
So moving on from that ensemble to another ensemble that played in Tuscaloosa this past week at the Bama Art House, a film that Graham saw in New York City is Woody Allen's newest, To Rome with Love. He continues his European tour. Here he is in Rome, and he's telling a story featuring an ensemble in multiple storylines here. You have, I think, four different storylines all happening at once that are not connected with one another. So he's going back and forth quite a bit in this movie. Now, Graham told me early on, and I don't mean to spoil your perspective here, Graham, that this was lower tier Woody Allen. He said this was down there with the likes of Anything Else and Whatever Works. And so that really lowered my expectations going into it, obviously. But Woody Allen is a guy whom you give a chance no matter what, especially for the three of us. We're all big fans. But Corey, before I say what I think of the movie, I'm just curious, do you agree with Graham?
Yeah, you know, I saw this a couple weeks ago in Birmingham, and I do agree with Graham. But like you said, I'll always go into a Woody Allen movie with the highest expectations just because he deserves them, and with an expectation that I'm going to get some level of enjoyment out of it no matter what, because he makes a movie a year, you go into it, and sometimes it's a great movie and sometimes it's not a great movie, but there's never any circumstance in which I would be discouraged about his next movie or discouraged about his what he has coming up, because the fact is, I mean, in every Woody Allen movie, you've got some really great moments, even if the movie's not very good, and you've got some good jokes. And that's how I felt about To Rome with Love. Ultimately, I don't think all of the storylines coalesce in this movie. I'm pretty disappointed by the Alec Baldwin, Jesse Eisenberg subplot. But then there are a couple subplots here that really do work for me. There's an opera singer who's can only sing in very specific circumstances, and the way that gag plays out always got a laugh from me. And then you've got this story following two newlyweds from the Italian countryside who come into Rome that I was really involved with, even when I wasn't involved with the other stories. And then on top of all of that, it really just is a pleasure to see Woody Allen on the screen again. He makes his return in front of the camera in the first of his movies since Scoop, I think, with this one. So, you know, even though I don't think that this is a very good Woody Allen movie, and it's probably lower tier for me, there's always a lot to enjoy in these movies.
I gotta say, when I went into this movie knowing how Graham felt about it, and it finally played out, I thought he was crazy, because I think it is a good Woody Allen movie, and I do agree that the four stories, they're not very tidily wrapped up. In fact, it gets pretty sloppy in a way those other bad movies that we had mentioned earlier, in a way that those movies are from beginning to end. But I think the first hour of To Rome with Love is really strong. And it might help that the crowd that I saw it with was so into it. And I think they were just really excited to see a Woody Allen movie in a theater, number one. And like you said, to see Woody Allen on screen. His jokes played the strongest of anybody in the house. And he actually was great. I thought his timing was as good as ever. And his character was really funny. He plays this music producer and opera director who discovers this man's talent in Italy. And I thought that whole sequence where the guy could only sing under those certain circumstances, to me, that was right out of a Woody Allen prose book, and one of those ideas that are just too outrageous for film in some regards, but I think he made it work extremely well. And I had to ask myself, with each of these four storylines, would it be better if this wasn't a film that had multiple storylines, and should he have picked one and just sort of run with it? And I don't think any of them would have worked as a feature film, but some are definitely stronger than others. It was great seeing Roberto Benigni on screen again under Allen's direction. I thought he was really good, but that's another one that just didn't wrap up very well. I thought it got, again, very sloppy towards the end. But I think up until the final moments of the movie, or the last 20 minutes or so, it was some of his strongest comedy writing that I can remember in recent years. Just the one-liners, the jokes, the sight gags were so good. But Graham, you totally disagree with me here. And again, you hold this in similar regard to Whatever Works and Anything Else at the bottom of the Woody Allen barrel.
I won't say that they're that bad, you know, because upon reflecting about the movie, and I do feel like, yes, I was disappointed by this movie, namely by the, as Corey mentioned, the Jesse Eisenberg sequence. There's not really anything that I enjoyed about that. But with the opera bit, I agree with you. That felt like a concept that you would have found in one of his short stories. I just felt like a lot of, you know, the material that makes up that sequence of the movie, especially Woody Allen's dialogue, was painful to me and just not funny. Roberto Benigni's sequence, I also enjoyed him for the most part, but there are a lot of lulls in that as well. I feel like the one bit that worked pretty consistently for me was the one with Penelope Cruz. I had a lot of laughs and was sexy, and you know, I feel like this movie honestly is really going to appeal more to Italians, because it's like peppered with all these Italian actors, we have no idea who they are. And I think one of the biggest jokes was that the guy that tries to seduce the young man's fiance or new wife is supposed to be this suave actor, but he's this overweight, balding, kind of disgusting pig, which, you know, on the surface is funny, but I think for somebody that knows who that guy is, would be even funnier. This movie, I sort of feel the way I feel about Alabama football right now. Okay, so bear with me for a second. Woody Allen, before this movie, made what I consider to be a masterpiece. You know, it equals Alabama winning a national championship. You know, it's like a great team or a great director just pulling off the ultimate feat, right? So going into this, I didn't really have high expectations for it. I wasn't expecting a repeat of another masterpiece like this year with Alabama. We just won the national championship. Yes, I'm going in with some expectations, and I want them to do well, and I expect them to do well, but I'm not expecting perfection. But now, when you are let down a little bit, as we were with South Carolina, even if your expectations weren't that high, now that they've kind of fallen off, you're ready for them to get back on, and now the pressure's back on. So now I'm really hoping that Woody can kind of pull through and put one in the plus column on this next one, whatever it is, and sort of tighten up his game. I think he can. That's exactly what happened with Alabama in 2011. You know, they made some mistakes in 2010, and they got it together, and they came through, obviously. So that's sort of like the parallel that I see, if that makes any sense.
Corey, what's it going to take for Woody Allen to raise another Crystal Football Trophy?
Well, he cast Louis C.K. in his next movie, so that's a start.
I just had fun with this movie. The way he has, I think, referred to his films before, kind of like this, it's just kind of a trifle, and spending it in a very scenic environment like Rome, I think it's really nicely shot, this movie, especially in the urban areas. Obviously, they're in Rome, so you're mostly in urban settings, but I just really enjoyed it. To me, I think this is the better version of what You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger was. I would take this over that, and I would file them in the same category.
Not me. You Want Me to Tall but Dark Stranger is just so much more focused and funny.
That movie is not focused.
So much funnier.
All.
I think it totally is focused. There's like a clean storyline throughout the entire thing. Everything that goes around comes around. It's just a solid, well-formed work. And this is just obviously, you know, all over the place, which I don't fault him for making a movie with vignettes or what have you, but they just didn't pay off for me. And I do not begrudge anybody enjoying this movie. You know, I hope people enjoy it. You know, I'm not saying don't watch it, don't like it. And I'll definitely give it another shot, but I would definitely say that it is not in the same league as You'll Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, which is highly underrated in my opinion.
Corey, you said you were disappointed with the Alec Baldwin, Jesse Eisenberg storyline. I actually thought that at first glance, Ellen Page seemed extremely miscast as this sex kitten.
Second glance, she did too.
No, not at all, because she, as Alec Baldwin, sort of the conscience of this Jesse Eisenberg character, and he was right, she's a total fraud. She's a bad actress, and she's trying to come across as this sex goddess who has had all of these experiments throughout her life, when in actuality, like they point out, she memorizes one line from every author's poetry that she can so she can impress potential suitors and come off as this just irresistible taste of sexual freedom for the Jesse Eisenberg character, who's willing to give up on his perfectly harmless girlfriend played by Greta Gerwig here. But I really liked that aspect, and it felt like a new-ish Woody Allen female character, which I liked a lot. And I thought Alec Baldwin had a ton of great one-liners, especially when they're at the Roman bathhouses or something like that, and they're playing in the rain, and Jesse Eisenberg wants to zero in on Ellen Page finally, and Alec Baldwin tells him, okay, go ahead, walk into the propeller. And I just thought that was really funny. It got a great laugh from the crowd. But what about that storyline and any other in the movie just didn't totally gel for you?
I mean, apart from it being a bit more abstract just in concept than the others, I kind of feel like it's building towards something that it never really reaches. It sort of ends on this sort of downer note, because it ends basically how I expected it to, but it didn't leave the best taste in my mouth. I wasn't really that satisfied with the way it wrapped up. Not to mention, I'm not a fan of Paige in this role, and I had high hopes for Jesse Eisenberg in a Woody Allen movie, and I just feel like his performance is pretty one-note, sort of the Woody Allen role that so many lazy critics tend to try to project on his characters. I feel like there's a lot more potential with these actors in the storyline that this didn't really hit for me. It just didn't feel that inspired, and I just kind of wanted it to be better than it was. I enjoyed the other three storylines more, and when it would cut to this one, I was kind of like, all right, well, let's get through this. I just feel like, just from casting to writing to execution, it just didn't really gel.
I know you two will give this another chance.
Yeah, absolutely.
You give Woody Allen's work multiple chances throughout his career, and I think you're going to like it a lot more than you did. I at least hope so, but some people that we should point out, I think Woody Allen was funny. I think it was nice to see Judy Davis again in a Woody Allen movie. He didn't give her a lot to do other than insult Woody Allen as his wife. Penelope Cruz was outstanding.
She's really good.
Yeah.
She really was. I thought she was as good in this, honestly, as she was in Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Let's not go nuts.
I agree.
Well, I'm just saying, I think she was as good, even if her character might not have had as much depth. She just played it to the T perfectly. And I love the opera singer. His son was funny, and all of Woody Allen's communist jokes and
those were good.
And Undertaker jokes. The first time he meets the Undertaker opera singer, when he shakes his hand, the look on Woody's face when he says, "I haven't washed up, you know, I just got done with work." It's classic, classic Woody Allen stuff.
The movie started out on a high note for me because, like, the first joke in the entire movie is Woody Allen's on the plane heading to Rome, and then the pilot says, "Bear with us, we're gonna headed through a storm. It might be a little bumpy." And Woody Allen goes, "Turbulence, my favorite." And I love that. I was like, yes, here we go. All right. But nothing ever really got back to that level for me.
Well, then he follows that up, though, because he meets the son. He says, "How was your flight?" He says, "Oh, it was good." He says, "You might read about it if they find the black box." I love that stuff.
That's a good line. You know, you mentioned that you saw this in a mostly, you know, almost packed house at the Bama Theater. I saw this totally by myself. I was the only person in my screening. So if the audience experience enhances movies like this with, you know, everybody laughing at the jokes, and also movies like The Expendables 2 with, you know, I saw that in a packed house and people literally stood up and cheered at moments. Just seeing a movie like this and being the only person in the theater, you know, probably doesn't really help the viewing experience all that much. So I'm looking forward to seeing this again. I wish I'd been able to go to the Bama on Tuesday.
Well, each of these films featured really strong ensemble work, in my opinion anyway, and I think mostly in yours. And we're going to talk a lot about our favorite movie ensembles when we come back. So let's take a quick break. This is Aspect Radio.
And there you guys were in class trying to list all the Gilligan's Island episodes without even a hint of irony.
What in the hell are you talking about, girl?
You weren't thinking about it, were you?
Gilligan's Island?
It's what's called a male pornographic fantasy.
Oh, my.
Think about it.
You're basically alone on a deserted island with two readily available women. One, a seductive sex goddess type. The other, a healthy girl next door type with a nice butt.
So guys have it all. The Madonna and the whore. And women get nothing. We get a geek, an overweight middle-aged guy, some nerdy scientific type. I mean, the professor is sexy.
Welcome back to Aspect Radio with my co-host Corey Kraft. We're also joined by my brother Graham Flanagan, who is up in New York City, and we're here to talk about our favorite movie ensembles. And we're going to give you a top five like the one we gave you last time with our favorite movie comedy duels, where we give you our three favorite ensembles, one worst ensemble ever, and one underrated ensemble. Now, Corey, criteria here for this doesn't seem to be difficult other than, what do you consider an ensemble? Is it a film that has 10 or more featured characters where the screen time is split as equally as it can be, or did you go lower than that at times?
I probably went lower than that at times, but that's sort of the same spirit. A movie that mostly focuses on one character with a massive supporting cast was not really considered in my lists, but I mean, there are a number of what you'd call ensemble comedies and ensemble dramas in which multiple actors, not to put a number on it or anything, get a chance to shine. And we have favorite filmmakers, I think, who regularly do that. So I just sort of tried to pick movies where there were multiple and sizable speaking roles in important ways.
Graham, did you have any criteria you wanted to add to it?
No, I mean, because I thought, you know, does it have to be a movie where there's no real star? But then some of the choices that I ended up making sort of have a main character, like a lead protagonist, but they're supported by like a big group. And I thought that should also be considered an ensemble. So no, not really. I mean, I think you'll agree that mine are ensemble casts, but no, not really.
This was a really hard list for me to make. There's so many great ensembles out there, and it was hard for me to pick my worst pick, too, actually. It was harder last time with the movie Comedy Duels because I couldn't really think of one. Yeah. This time, I thought of too many, and it was hard to narrow it down. But I think I've got a good one. But Graham, why don't we start off with you, your first favorite ensemble?
Okay, my first favorite ensemble is Caddyshack. It's probably my favorite comedy of all time, and this one doesn't really have a chief protagonist. I mean, I guess you could say that Danny Noonan is, but he's joined by so many colorful characters, you know, Chevy Chase, Rodney Dangerfield, of course, Ted Knight, who is just spectacular in this. And I would probably, you know, if anybody gets nominated for an Oscar for Caddyshack, I think Ted Knight. And then obviously the fan favorite, Bill Murray. And that's sort of the main cast. But then you've got a lot of small roles, you know, like Lacey Underall, the Bishop, D'Annunzio, and Brian Doyle Murray is the head of the Caddyshack. And it's just so many different characters, and it's so colorful that this was just a sort of an easy pick to make, because when you know you love every scene of a movie, it's usually because all the characters and all the actors are really delivering, and I think that's the case with Caddyshack.
And what was Ted Knight's nephew's name in the
Spalding.
Movie?
Spalding.
Spalding. Yeah, yeah. What a great character.
Yeah, and then there's a puppet too, you know, so it's got it all.
It's a good pick. I'll go ahead with my first favorite, and I want to preface this by saying I'm leaving two off, two of my favorite films of all time, two films that I think are in my top 10. One is my favorite. It's Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, maybe the greatest ensemble ever, but my favorite movie ever. The other is 12 Angry Men. This may or may not come up again, but for so long, this has been one of my favorite movies, and it's just something that can come up in any conversation or any list that we might make, so I'm going to leave that one off. I'll start. What I want to do here is I want to name some actors in this movie, and I want to see if you can guess it.
Okay.
There are a lot of famous people in these movies, but I want to see if you can get the obscure ones as I build up to the famous people. So with my first, I'll start with Nina Hartley, Nicole Ari Parker.
Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights. And I'll just read the rest of the names. Mark Wahlberg, Burt Reynolds, Julianne Moore, John C. Reilly, Don Cheadle, Heather Graham, Rob Ridgely as the Colonel, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Thomas Jane. We haven't seen that Thomas Jane since this
movie. No, we haven't.
Alfred Molina, did I say Philip Baker Hall or Philip Seymour Hoffman? Anyway, you get both of them. One of Philip Seymour Hoffman's greatest performances in William H. Macy. It's just an incredible cast, and they're utilized to their fullest potential in this movie. Obviously, Paul Thomas Anderson has a couple of films that are definitely eligible for this list, if not all of his movies. They all have great ensemble casts, but to me, this one is his greatest. This is just an electric film that relies on their performances, and they're anchored by the performances of Mark Wahlberg and Burt Reynolds, who have never, ever been better. This is just a cast's film, an actor's film, with incredible writing. And it's just amazing how you can collect all of that talent for one project and realize its true potential. And I think Boogie Nights is the best example of that.
Yeah, that's a great pick. With my picks, I kind of wanted to just limit myself to one film per filmmaker, because I feel like this entire list could be theoretically made up of films by Wes Anderson, Woody Allen, and Paul Thomas Anderson if I wanted to do that, but I didn't. And in fact, I left off some pretty obvious choices just to get to some more obscure ones, but I did leave off Reservoir Dogs like you, Pulp Fiction, and 12 Angry Men, because that just seems like the gold standard. But my first pick, I've got the list of the names in front of me too, so I'll start listing them off and see how well you do with this. All right. From the bottom, Lyle Lovett, Buck Henry.
I think I know it.
Player.
It? The Player. Yep.
Nope.
Oh, no, really?
Nope. Francis McDormand, Tom Waits.
Shortcuts.
Shortcuts.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good pick.
Also starring Julianne Moore, Andy McDowell, Jack Lemmon, Bruce Davison, Matthew Modine, Ann Archer, Fred Ward, Lily Tomlin, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Chris Penn, Lily Taylor, Robert Downey Jr., Madeline Stowe, Peter Gallagher, and Tim Robbins.
Stacked.
You know, Robert Altman knew a thing or two about assembling ensemble casts. The Player is a great example. Nashville is a great example. But Shortcuts, his sprawling Los Angeles epic that Paul Thomas Anderson borrows a thing or two from for his film Magnolia, one of my favorite films of all time. I mean, Shortcuts is just this wonderfully naturalistic, Raymond Carver-based look at this wide-ranging group of people whose choices sometimes interact and affect each other. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're just living their lives near each other and totally independently. And it's just this wonderful slice of life that gets really, I don't know, into each of these characters. I mean, it's a very long movie, but we don't spend all that much time with these actors. And yet, I feel like most of them create these really indelible characters in the time that they get in this movie. It's really terrific.
Good one. Graham, your next one?
I'll play this game too. Let's see how you guys do. Okay, here we go. Bryan Cranston, Dennis Farina, Paul Giamatti, Ted Danson, Matt Damon.
Oh, this is Saving Private Ryan.
Yep. I had forgotten Bryan Cranston was in this.
Yeah.
You know who else is in it? Is Nathan Fillion.
Nathan Fillion is the other Ryan. Private Ryan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Graham.
Yeah, I mean, this movie it's obviously not a lot of women, not a lot of love for the girls in this one, but just outstanding. And this is an example where, you know, you've got a lead character, Tom Hanks, you've got a main protagonist, but he just has so much support. You know, basically the story allows that to happen where he has to assemble a team. And this whole movie is about the team. I mean, Tom Sizemore, Edward Burns, Barry Pepper, Adam Goldberg, Vin Diesel, Giovanni Ribisi, Jeremy Davies, and all those other folks that I mentioned before. It's just spectacular. Unfortunately, obviously Matt Damon's gone on to bigger and better things, but you could arguably say that Barry Pepper, who showed so much promise here, and you know, a lot of people thought this guy was going to be a huge star. Probably could have achieved what we're seeing happen with Jeremy Renner. You know, never really capitalized on his potential. And obviously Vin Diesel went on to a lot of commercial success. But, I mean, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I think that we thought big things were coming from all of those guys after that movie, including Jeremy Davies, too, who went on to do a lot of interesting work. But he really, I think, shined for a lot of people and was a potential Oscar contender for that. So I'm a little disappointed to see that he hasn't quite equaled what he did in that movie, but he and other actors in it have definitely done interesting work since then.
Yeah, Jeremy Davies is probably my favorite performer in that ensemble, but a lot of great people in the movie.
That's an honorable mention for me. My next one, we'll keep going with this guessing game. I'll try to throw you off a little bit.
Okay.
John Slattery, Viola Davis, Miguel Ferrer.
Traffic.
That's it. And I'll round it out. Michael Douglas, Benicio del Toro, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Don Cheadle, Luis Guzman, Dennis Quaid, Erica Christensen, Topher Grace, Clifton Collins Jr. as Frankie Flowers.
Throwing a fastball there. He's awesome. Oh, man.
Jacob Vargas, who plays Manolo. Mm-hmm. And you have Tomas Milian, who plays Salazar, who's fantastic.
Yeah.
But Traffic's one of my all-time favorite films ever, just off of my top 10. Soderbergh's greatest triumph, in my opinion, even though he's done incredible work since that movie. Not to say he hasn't come close to equaling it, but it's an amazing saga about the war on drugs that just sprawls across two different countries, from Lower California to Tijuana, Mexico, and Washington, D.C. too. I think in Cincinnati, I think, is featured in the movie. It's just amazing how he ties it all together, and he couldn't do it without this cast in particular, again, who are just firing on all cylinders. Features an Oscar winner, Benicio del Toro, for his work as Javier Rodriguez, the reluctant cop there who is somehow not corrupt in this wave of corruption in the war on drugs and somehow does the right thing when it seems impossible. But Traffic is fantastic. So, Corey, we go to you.
Well, this is another film that's standing in as sort of representative of the work of one filmmaker, but it's probably not a film by this filmmaker that too many people ever think about. It's one that I really like a lot. So here we go, from the bottom. Liv Tyler,
Empire
Natalie
Records.
Portman. No. Good guess, though. Natalie Portman, Gabby Hoffman, Edward Norton, Tim Roth, Drew Barrymore.
Everyone Says I Love You?
That's right. Followed up with Woody Allen, Goldie Hawn, Julia Roberts, and Alan Alda. This is Woody Allen's 1996 foray into the movie musical. It has one of his most accomplished and, I don't know, just one of his most accomplished casts who are having a really great time, even though, as the legend goes, none of them were told that they were making a musical before they signed on to do it. It also features, in a very small role, Billy Crudup, I think, as one of Natasha Lyonne's boyfriends, I guess. Anyway, I love that movie. I adore Everyone Says I Love You. And it's not Woody's best movie, and it's not his largest ensemble, and it probably doesn't feature his best or most detailed character work, but for my money, this is probably one of his more entertaining films. I'd take this over, say, Deconstructing Harry, which has a larger ensemble than this.
Yeah, certainly one of his most delightful movies.
Yeah.
But Graham, your last favorite?
My favorite, John Travolta, Nobody.
Hairspray?
Broken Arrow. No, no, Pulp Fiction. I know Corey left it off because it was too obvious. I mean, I thought of this earlier and I just had to go with it for my number one. Then after that, I went and looked at some lists of, there's one from this site called like Total Film that had Pulp Fiction as number one. I mean, obviously it's pretty predictable, but I just think that so many people are just on fire here. One of my favorite characters is Bruce Willis. I think that's some of the best work he's ever done. That's saying a lot. I mean, he's done so much great work, but then you've got Christopher Walken who pops up. You got Tim Roth in sort of a cameo. Harvey Keitel. Quentin Tarantino's great. We can go on and on, and you guys know, and our audience knows, but this to me just, it just works. You've got just so much great acting happening with such a great script. It's just, it's synergy happening in this movie.
My last one I think is going to be very easy, but I'll try and say some of the more obscure names to throw you off a little bit. Nikki Catt, Esteban Powell.
Dazed and Confused.
That's it? Wow. Dazed Nicely and Confused. Done. Some of these people went on to bigger and better things, obviously, like Matthew McConaughey and Ben Affleck in a great performance. I would consider this a top three Affleck performance. Maybe there are only three good Affleck performances, but this is definitely up there. But you've got the likes of Jason London, who did great work in it. Sasha Jensen, who I don't think I've seen since then, who plays Donnie, his best friend, who's hilarious. Wiley Wiggins. Adam Goldberg, again, Roy Cochran's hilarious, Sean Andrews, Mila Jovovich, Marissa Ribisi, that's Giovanni's sister, Cole Hauser, Dina Martin, the list just kind of goes on there, and it's just a really, really fantastic cast. There's a guy named David Blackwell I wanted to include. He's the convenience store clerk who sells Mitch the six-pack. He's fantastic, but anytime this movie's on, forget about it. I'm going to watch it. It's an annual watch at least. It's my favorite Richard Linklater movie, one of my favorite movies of all time. Never get tired of it. Think I know every single line, but just one of the most appealing, most vibrant casts that I can think of, especially folks with so much inexperience in the industry. A lot of these people had been in some movies in their lifetime, but this is made up of an entirely young cast, and when you put it in the hands of people who aren't what you would consider veterans, like you see in Boogie Nights or obviously 12 Angry Men in a room full of character actors, seasoned veterans, the results might not be as good as what they turned out to be in Dazed and Confused, but it's one of my favorite movies.
That's a good pick. My last pick, this is the smallest ensemble on my list, and it's also just a totally obvious pick. So,
Bobby.
No. Let's see. Jonathan Pryce, Alec Baldwin,
Glengarry Glen Ross.
Glen Ross, Al Pacino, Ed Harris, Kevin Spacey, Jack Lemmon, and Alan Arkin. Most of those people are giving the best performances of their career so far in Glengarry Glen Ross, based on David Mamet's play. I think that Jack Lemmon's portrayal in particular is heartbreaking and iconic. Alec Baldwin, I'd say that everything past Glengarry Glen Ross has been sort of a pale imitation of what he did in that movie. You've got Kevin Spacey at his smarmy best, and you've got, I don't know, just a great Al Pacino performance, one of the few that we've gotten since 1990. I guess.
And that was well before Kevin Spacey sort of blew up, too, as a mainstream threat.
Yeah, great movie. And, you know, Alan Arkin and Ed Harris are awesome, too. That seems like an obvious choice, but I couldn't leave it off. It's just too good.
Well, let me drop some honorable mentions real quick. You already mentioned Saving Private Ryan, the other World War II movie that year, Thin Red Line, Usual Suspects, Magnolia, Glengarry Glen Ross, Ocean's 11 in particular, but all those Ocean's movies are great. American Graffiti, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, that's a good pick.
Pulp Fiction, JFK, Snatch. Finding Nemo, I think, was a really solid voice ensemble. And, you know, in honor of Tony Scott, obviously, I think Enemy of the State has a really solid ensemble.
I can't believe I left off JFK. I love that movie.
And I think if you're going to say JFK, you also have to throw Nixon in there. Just a laundry list of classic actors.
I have some runners-up, too. The Thin Red Line was one of mine. Jackie Brown, which is just sort of, I guess, the not obvious Tarantino pick, but I think that cast is awesome. Boogie Nights is one of mine. Another Altman movie, Gosford Park. A special nod of the head to Wes Anderson and Christopher Guest for assembling mostly the same cast in all of those movies, particularly Christopher Guest, but those casts are great. And from last year, one of the most, I guess, insidious movies of last year, something that gets under your skin and you can't stop thinking about it, and just a really, really great ensemble work from pretty much everybody in it. It's Thomas Alfredson's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Great ensemble there.
Graham, any honorable mentions you want to throw out there?
You guys mentioned a lot that would have been on my list. I'll say The Mighty Ducks, D2. I mean, whatever casting director put together that ragtag group of American heroes deserves the Thalberg Award.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on the worst because it'll make me sick to my stomach, especially my pick. But one I came up with off the top of my head was this sequel to Get Shorty, Be Cool.
Oh, man.
It's so awful. And it has John Travolta, Uma Thurman, Danny DeVito, The Rock, Vince Vaughn, Cedric the Entertainer, Andre 3000, Debbie Mazar, Harvey Keitel, James Woods, and a bunch of celebrities as themselves. But when I really thought about it, and the light bulb finally came on and then burst, it's the entire Star Wars prequel saga.
Damn.
Just...
Not even exempting Ewan McGregor from that?
Look, he does some good things, but he's a part of it. He's definitely a part of it. Yeah, he was there. So he, unfortunately, it's just a black spot on the lung of filmmaking and casting. It's just one of the saddest Damn. Things ever. Yeah, and the cast was just such a... Obviously, this is all under George Lucas's watch, and they're having to spew his horrible dialogue throughout all three of these movies. But they're also just terrible. And even great actors can sometimes enhance bad material.
Not there,
apparently. So I want to quit talking about this now.
Well, I'm kind of mad that Graham brought up my worst by suggesting that it could have been my pick for best. It's Bobby, the sort of cautionary tale of how the best intentions will sometimes go horribly awry, especially when you have compiled a cast that includes such thespians as Ashton Kutcher, Lindsay Lohan, Shia LaBeouf, Heather Graham, Freddie Rodriguez, Joshua Jackson, and Christian Slater, alongside some pretty good actors doing terrible work in this movie, like Anthony Hopkins, William H. Macy, Lawrence Fishburne, and Martin Sheen. And you've also got Helen Hunt and Demi Moore sort of... Oh, and Sharon Stone. So that's the trifecta of 90s actresses who haven't made anything good since the 1990s. Just a mess. Just a disaster. And props, I guess, to writer-director Emilio Estevez for trying.
I guess.
But man...
Interesting pick. Graham, what's your worst?
For me, it's Grown Ups, because 2010 Adam Sandler movie, which actually was a smash hit, and they're making a sequel, I believe, that's coming out next summer. I mean, look, you've got, as a fan of Saturday Night Live, that grew up watching it in the 90s, where Adam Sandler, Chris Rock, David Spade, Rob Schneider, and Tim Meadows were all cast members, so the idea of having them all in a movie together is very appealing. I mean, and you'd think, all right, this could be great. But it wasn't. It was disappointing. It had some funny moments, which were mostly thanks to Steve Buscemi. There are actually a couple hilarious scenes in the movie involving him, but it's a bad movie. It really is. And it's just a shame to kind of bring back all those great memories of staying up and watching Saturday Night Live and all these guys and their classic skits, to put them all together in a movie and it just not pay off was a bummer.
Well, let's run through our underrated really quick. I know we're going to talk about some great movies, but all I'm going to do is name one character from my movie. And I don't think that this film is underappreciated or even its main cast is, but I think the rest of its cast, this movie would not exist without it or be as just authentic as it is without the rest of its cast. And it's amazing. It gets the sense of place better than any movie I think has ever been made. But let me just throw one name out there. Riley Diefenbach.
Fargo.
That's it. Stan Grossman, Mike Yanagita, Wade Gustafson. I mean, just incredible, incredible characters and performances, not only from Frances McDormand, who won an Oscar, and William H. Macy, who probably deserved to win that year, and the likes of Steve Buscemi, Harv Presnell, Peter Stormare, but these names, John Carroll Lynch, Steve Riva, Steve Park, Kristen Rudrud, maybe, that I'm mispronouncing that, she played Mrs. Lundegaard, Tony Benman, who was Scotty, Gary Houston, and Larry Brandenburg. Gary Houston played the angry car customer says the F word for the first time in his life. What a great cast. And it's, again, it's another film that is in my top 10 of all time. So I'm going to run out of reasons to talk about these movies, but never run out of reasons to watch them. So, Graham, let's hear your underrated.
My underrated is going back to Woody Allen, A Midsummer Night Sex Comedy from 1982. I've talked about this movie before, and it's one of my favorite Woody Allen movies. And I don't think it gets enough love. I don't think that people pay enough attention to it. I can't remember. There was a documentary, not the most recent Woody Allen movie, but one before that came out. And there was not one mention, single mention of this movie in it. And I thought that was just a big insult to the movie. It's shot by Gordon Willis. It's beautiful. But the cast is Woody Allen, Mia Farrow, Jose Ferrer, Julie Haggerty, Tony Roberts, Mary Steenburgen. This movie, Mia Farrow is actually nominated for a Razzie for Worst Actress. And it says here that this is the only time a Woody Allen movie has ever been nominated for a Razzie in any category. And I just think that speaks to the fact that people just didn't get it. It's just a delightful movie. It's very funny, but it's also very romantic and sweet and has a lot of drama and heavy issues about, you know, typical Woody Allen issues about existence and fidelity and things like that. But it's just, I love it. It's one of my favorite Woody Allen movies. I hope more people can give it a chance and enjoy it.
Well, I'm going to catch some hell for my pick. But this is a childhood favorite. And it holds up for me. But when you look at this cast, just on a piece of paper, and you've got Academy Award winner Rod Steiger, and you've got Natalie Portman.
Mars Attacks. I love it, man. It should have been on my honorable mentions list.
Mars Attacks is massively underrated as a film, and it assembled probably one of the best ensemble casts in the 1990s with Jack Nicholson, Glenn Close, Pierce Brosnan, Annette Bening, Danny DeVito, Martin Short, Sarah Jessica Parker, Michael J. Fox, Paul Winfield, Pam Grier, Jack Black, Christina Applegate, and then, of course, Jim Brown and Tom Jones. What's not to like about this movie and these performers in this movie, particularly since Tim Burton basically runs all of them through the ringer, and like two-thirds of them, if not more, end up murdered by the end of the movie.
Joe Don Baker, too.
Joe Don Baker.
As Jack Black's dad.
God, see? Lucas Haas, Sylvia Sidney. I could go on and on. This cast is just... it's just terrific, and it's a really funny movie.
Slim Pickens via record player.
Via record player. The most important character in the movie, perhaps.
And those damn aliens, too, man. That sound effect is just amazing. Yeah. No, it's a really great pick. Jack Nicholson, in both of his roles, is so funny
in
this movie. And you can imagine how that pitch went from Tim Burton to these actors, or from the studio to these actors. Basically, we're going to make Independence Day, but even dumber than that was. Yeah. But it's really funny. It's a great satirical comedy, and it seems like it's being stupid for stupid's sake. And even if that's the case,
it totally is the case. Even if that's the case, it's enjoyable.
Yeah, fine.
And I love Michael J. Fox is great in that movie.
Yeah,
too.
He is. Yeah, okay, I'm glad that this didn't go over as terribly as I thought it was.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Really funny movie. Really funny movie. So that's a good pick. So that rounds it out for our top five movie ensembles. Give us yours. We'd love to hear it. But let's move on to DVD and close things out. Corey, you know, we mentioned this last week, but my wife and I sat down after I purchased this shortly after we talked about it. We sat down and watched Jaws on Blu-ray.
Nice.
And the transfer is as advertised. It looks brand new during some of the sequences, but just to sit down and watch Jaws again from beginning to end, which is something I feel like I should do more often, it's as good as it ever was.
Well, also on DVD this week, Sacha Baron Cohen's latest dud, The Dictator. I didn't think very highly of this movie. Did you catch up with this?
No, I went to Redbox this week and picked up a couple of new titles.
Yeah, you picked up Richard Linklater's new film, Bernie, also on DVD.
Also a good ensemble, too, because you have three characters that have a lot of screen time, but the movie is made up of these interviews with some real people and some actors, and they are the heart of the movie. And it takes place in this, I think, northeastern Texas town. And it tells this very kind of creepy but fun story through black comedy, I guess, and a really great Jack Black and Matthew McConaughey set of performances.
They're both terrific.
Yeah.
I really like Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah, she's good, too.
I think all three of the principal cast members are great. Some of the actors playing townspeople in this movie aren't really actors either. Like, Matthew McConaughey's mom is one of the women interviewed in the movie, which is really funny to me. Also on DVD and Blu-ray this week, the winner of the most recent Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film and a nominee for Best Original Screenplay, Asghar Farhadi's Separation. I hadn't seen this movie until Tuesday, and it's worth the hype. It really is. It's really, really tremendous. And it's one of those movies like Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret that I just wish that I had seen last year. Because I now, finally, in August, I feel like I can put 2011 behind me by having seen The Separation. But, I mean, it's really just terrific.
It's sitting in my DVD player right now, ready to be watched.
You're in for a treat.
Can't wait. So, is that it?
That rounds it up. It was kind of a minor DVD release week. Though I will mention, in light of the BAM Art House series, I watched Sarah Polley's new film, Take This Waltz, on VOD over the last week. And that's worth seeing.
Yeah, I'm going to see it when it's at the Art House, so maybe we can talk about it after that.
Yeah, I think we should.
I just wanted to make a quick DVD pick. I watched Casa de Mi Padre over the weekend.
How was it?
I thought it was great. It was hilarious. Definitely glad that I waited to watch it on demand for $5, but I really enjoyed it. And one thing that it got right, the Expendables didn't, was a very cheesy sex scene. Have either of you seen it yet?
I saw it.
The sex scene is literally all about ass. It's just ass, just close-ups of ass. It's like one of those perfect, like, partial nudity sex scenes. Like, no frontal nudity at all. It's just all about butts, and the butts are like beautifully lit at different angles and whatnot. And that's one scene that the Expendables 2 was lacking, I thought. But I definitely enjoyed it, and I think you'd like it, Ben.
Well, opening nationwide at the Cobb Hollywood 16 in Tuscaloosa is Premium Rush, which is starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Michael Shannon, directed by David Koepp. Looking forward to it. The Apparition, Thunderstruck with NBA superstar Kevin Durant is coming to Tuscaloosa.
It's coming everywhere. Apparently.
The basketball and movie gods are teasing me, man, and really testing me.
You're going to go see
They're really
don't
testing
even,
me.
Don't even deny it, man.
You're are gonna you going to see
I,
it?
I'm not going to make any promises either way right now because I've mentioned before, not on this show, but obviously this reminds people of the movie Like Mike that came out with a little Bow Wow, who, you know, becomes an NBA player because of some magic shoes. I saw that movie on opening day.
Oh, my God.
And, look, I was, I think, 19 years old or so when that came out. Opening day on, I think, July 4th weekend. You know, a much better, cooler movie probably came out that day, but, nope, I wanted to see the NBA movie. Had to. Also starting this week is the Dax Shepard passion project Hit and Run, which he wrote and directed. Corey, have you already been there?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
Playing at the Bama Art House next Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. will be Beasts of the Southern Wild, a film that we'll definitely talk about. Corey has seen it.
Yeah, I look forward to talking about it with you. Also, on Wednesday, August 29th, in wide release, is John Hillcoat's new film, Lawless, with Tom Hardy, Jessica Chastain, Shia LaBeouf, Guy Pearce, and Gary Oldman.
One of those is not like the others.
One of those is probably not like the others.
No,
right.
No, but I'll definitely see it because of the others.
Yeah.
Something we should note right now is that the Sidewalk Film Festival in Birmingham is happening this weekend, and our friend and contributor to this show, Ben Stark, his film, his debut feature film, The Nocturnal Third, which he wrote and directed, will be showing on Saturday, I believe, at 10:30 a.m.
Right. In
Birmingham. Check sidewalkfest.com for the listings there, but go out and support local filmmakers playing.
It's the only Alabama-shot feature-length narrative. I mean, there's some documentaries, but...
Yeah, a guy that, I don't know if you took any of his classes, but Andrew Grace...
Yeah.
His film, Eating Alabama, it's a documentary that has drawn some wide acclaim as he's toured it throughout the United States. He played it at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and it garnered some acclaim there, but it's playing at Sidewalk as well, so definitely go check that out.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. They're playing some other movies that look pretty good to me, too.
Like, what else are you looking forward to?
Craig Zobel's second film, Compliance, which has received some pretty controversial word of mouth coming out of Sundance. It's now in limited release in New York, opening in LA and other cities across the country on Friday, the day before it plays at the Sidewalk Film Festival. This will likely be the only time this film ever plays in the state of Alabama, so I'm looking forward to checking that out. Also, the found footage horror anthology VHS is playing at Sidewalk. That looks like it could be a fun time for people who like that sort of thing. The Danish comedy Clown, which has received a lot of positive notices, is playing. Unfortunately, that overlaps with VHS, so there's going to have to be a difficult choice between those two. And on Sunday, a film that looks pretty out there, visually at least, is Panos Cosmatos' film Beyond the Black Rainbow, which appears to be this 80s-inspired hallucinogenic thriller. Hopefully that's, less totally ridiculous than it looks, but I don't know. And then also Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim star in a film called The Comedy, which by all accounts out of Sundance is not in fact a comedy. That also plays Sunday night. So the full schedule is at sidewalkfest.com, and I wrote something up for this week's edition of Tusk in the Tuscaloosa News. I'm sure you're writing something up for AL.com. But, you know, obviously there are a ton of films playing, and you can actually go to sidewalkfest.com and create your own personalized schedule to sort of help you get through each of these days, because you're going to need to do it. I've done it like 5 times. I keep changing it. So definitely check that out.
Definitely looking forward to it. Time now for one parting shot from our friend and contributor, Ben Stark, the director of Nocturnal Third, again, whose film will be playing at Sidewalk on Saturday at 10:30 a.m.
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark with Wonder Mill Films up here in Huntsville. Just wanted to check in real quick, drop a quick parting shot about my top 5 most anticipated movies at the Sidewalk Film Festival this weekend in Birmingham. Number 5 is a cheap plug, of course. It's my film, The Nocturnal Third. It's playing at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday. I'd love to see a lot of people there. And as I recall, you Aspect Radio guys enjoyed it. My number 4 is a movie called Compliance. It's a low-budget thriller that has got a pretty good amount of buzz here lately and looks to be a really taut and tense thriller along the lines of something like Bubble from Steven Soderbergh. Number 3 is Dead Man's Burden. That's a Western starring Barlow Jacobs, who is a young actor that was in Shotgun Stories, the first film by Jeff Nichols, which is very good. Dead Man's Burden is a Western, and it's playing on Sunday at 2:45 in the afternoon. It looks to be a really moody kind of alt-Western, and that's the kind of thing I really enjoy. That's 3. Number 2 is Eating Alabama, a documentary by Andy Grace, who is actually my old boss when I worked at the Alabama Public Television Production House. It's a really neat documentary about Andy and his wife eating nothing but food that they've come up with over the course of a number of months, and I've been really excited to see it for a long time, and I'm excited to see it finally on Saturday at 6:15. And my number 1 most anticipated film is Beyond the Black Rainbow, which looks to be kind of a psychedelic, kind of non-linear mishmash of Blade Runner and Tron and all of these other kind of early 80s sci-fi films. It's got the potential to be kind of disturbing, kind of mind-bending, but the digital score and the cinematography and the production design just make it look like it's something that can't be missed. So that's playing Sunday night at 7:15, and I will see you there. I hope to see everybody else at the festival this weekend. It's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks again to my brother Graham for joining us. Graham, we really appreciate it. Are there any films up in New York that we can't see down here that you'll be checking out anytime soon?
I am going to see Cosmopolis.
Oh,
sure.
Nice.
I cannot wait. I kind of forgot about it, but because I was just talking to somebody about making plans to see Beasts of the Southern Wild next week, but I'm really pumped to go see Cosmopolis. I'm finally going to try and make a trip up to the new Lincoln Film Center Society Theater to check it out. So really pumped about seeing Cronenberg's latest, because I've really felt like he nailed it with Dangerous Method. So very pumped about finally getting to check that out. And Ben, real quick, if I could do kind of a live parting shot. Ever since last week's show, I was sort of taken to task without the chance to respond when you guys started chatting about my affinity for Jack and Jill, the 2011 Adam Sandler movie. Corey had some nasty things to say about it, as do most people. I think it swept the Razzies, if I'm not mistaken. Ben, you haven't seen it, have you?
I've only seen the clips that you keep sending me.
I just feel like this movie, while obviously it's not in the same league as Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore and The Wedding Singer, has one of the funniest, weirdest, most special things that Adam Sandler has brought to his audience in his entire career. And that is a fascinatingly bizarre and hilarious performance by Al Pacino as himself. And Pacino in this movie is obsessed with having sex with Adam Sandler's sister, who's also played by Adam Sandler, and she has no interest in him whatsoever. And honestly, beyond that, I think there are a lot of funny things about the character of Jill Adam Sandler's sister. Like that one gag where she just sweats through her entire bed and gets up in the bed is just like completely soaked in her overnight woman sweat. And then just lots of gags. Like, honestly, Corey, I do not see how you could not find Al Pacino's performance in this. Just completely hilarious.
He had one really great scene for me, or one really great line, where he brings Jill back to his place and she sees his Oscar and she's like, what, you only have one of those? And he says, you wouldn't think so, but yes. And he has this like really funny, like understated delivery of that line that is really,
but
really
like good. That's part of a bigger gag because he's like trying to teach her how to play stickball, like, because they both grew up in the Bronx. And then she hits the ball, and the ball shatters the Oscar. And she's like, oh, sorry, you probably have a lot of those. That's a great gag, but just, I don't know, man. I mean, that was special to me and unique. And you know, they went above and beyond to get that. And it's a shame that movie was, nobody walked into that giving it a chance. I think Armand White actually defends the movie, and I rarely want to side with him, but I have to agree with him. So that's my parting shot for the week.
Thanks for that, Graham, and thanks for your time here. We look forward to next time.
You can check us out at aspectradio.net. You can email any of your feedback to feedback@aspectradio.net. Find us at twitter.com/aspectradio or facebook.com/aspectradio. And check us out on al.com and tusk205.com.
Of course, find us on iTunes with a quick search or click the link on our blog. You can read Corey's DVD column in Tusk Magazine every Friday in the Tuscaloosa News or on tusk205.com. Follow his Tusk musings on Twitter @CoreyTuskMovies. Be sure to visit our friend Matt Scalici's website, filmnerds.com. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Andrew Richardson. And until next week, from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.
The need for speed.